quick maybe spot poll. How many of you guys, maybe leading into Thanksgiving and obviously December and the Christmas season, how many of you really look forward to it? It's kind of one of those things that you anticipate. I want you to be honest. The good, the right thing to say is, yes, of course I'm. But go ahead and raise your hand. How many of you really, truly look forward to it? Looks like about half of the folks in here. Good. So how many of you who raised your hand get about into mid-December and you wonder why you looked forward to it? Right? Anybody? Anybody get there? A few of you. Yeah. So here we are. What is today? 18th-ish of December. So we're like well into the Christmas season. And my guess is a few of you, if at least you're like me, a few of you are probably feeling kind of the weight of the holidays. For some of you, it's because of just plain busyness, right? There's a lot to do. There's a lot of people to please, a lot of people to go see, a lot of parties to attend. There's a lot of change in life, and oftentimes that can make us feel weary. You know, it can make us feel heavy. It can make us feel burdened. Isn't it ironic that here we are in this season of hope, and very often we enter this season. In fact, probably half of you didn't raise your hand that you don't look forward to it because you know kind of what the season brings, right? It brings a lot of stuff with it. Earlier, we were just praying for one guy in our community who just moved out of Denver back to a place where he's formerly lived. And he just lost his job in the midst of a move. He's about to be married in 2 weeks. Imagine the weight of the Christmas season that he is carrying. I mean, it is a burden that weighs unbelievably on his shoulders. If you want, join us in prayer for him. His name is Eric, and I know he would love it. He would love to know that his former community was praying for him. Some of you carry a kind of relational weight, right? Christmas is oftentimes the time when we gather together with family or friends, maybe that we haven't seen in some time. And relationships, while great and have incredible value to add to our life, relationships can oftentimes be a burden too, can't they? I mean, you get together with those people who you haven't seen in some time, and you got the smile and the cordial things going on, and you revisit, but after you get to the end of that thing, whatever it is that you've revisited, maybe the last year, you're not really sure what to say. Or maybe it's even worse. Maybe there's tension in your family or in relationships and friendships, and you get in kind of reacquainted with these people and realize why you don't like them in the first place, right? I mean, we have those kinds of times, and the holidays seem to carry that weightiness. And if it's not relationships, it's finances. I know for us, the holidays tend to be difficult because there's all kinds of expectations, parties to go to and gifts to buy and people to please and dinners to attend and all that kind of thing. And by the end, in fact, by this point, every dollar that goes out, I feel like is a dollar that I shouldn't be spending. You know that feeling? You know, you get to this point and you're like, doggone, it's the end of the year. It shouldn't feel like a weight, right? The holidays tend to do that to us. And yet again, ironically, it should be the exact opposite. This is a season of hope. Some of you are wondering about your future, right? Whether it's a job, could be a relationship, could be kind of direction in life, vocation, a place to live. Oftentimes we enter this season, and rather than it carrying hope, we carry kind of the burdens. And I certainly don't want to kind of cast a dark pall on this. But the reality is we all can be weary from time to time. Maybe it's not during the holidays, but in life, we're oftentimes faced with all kinds of stuff. The good news is this is a shared emotion. We're not alone. You know, here in Denver, Colorado, 2011, December 18th, this is a shared emotion. In fact, this is something that all people at all times and all places across all of humanity have experienced. Now, maybe it's not the stuff that we deal with or that you've dealt with, but all people have carried burdens. In fact, we've been studying a passage from the book of Isaiah. We heard from our transit girls just tonight, a little snippet from that passage. We're going to reread the passage. So if you've been tracking with us over the past couple of weeks, we're going to read it again for a third time. And that's not because we don't have enough stuff to go through in the scriptures, but because one, this is a really, really special passage in a great season. And two, if you're anything like me, repetition is a good thing to kind of repeat and revisit something. But this is a story about a people who are tremendously weary. They are very, very weary. We're going to be reading from the book of Isaiah. In fact, if you want to open to the book, the Bibles that are in the back of your back of the pews, this can be found on page 478. So 478 in these Bibles. We'll also put them up on screen. But let me give you a little context, a little background. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. In fact, if you haven't been tracking with us, Norton and Stephen really gave lots of historical and cultural context as to what's going on in the life of the nation of Israel. But I'll give you kind of a snippet. Here's the deal. Israel had a lot of junk going on. Now, first of all, they were a country. In fact, they were a clan of people that had been chosen by God to be a light to the rest of the world. They were kind of a no-name people in a no-name place. And God said, I want you to be a model for the rest of the world. And unfortunately, if you track with the nation of Israel, you can kind of see their roller coaster ride of sometimes they are a great model, but more often than not, they aren't. And this happens to be one of those times when they're not. Again, we're going to be reading from the book of Isaiah. And if you don't know anything about Isaiah, he's a prophet. And whenever you think of prophecy, I don't know what you think about, but I oftentimes think it's kind of foretelling the future, right? Prophet or a prophecy is basically kind of predicting the future. And that does happen in the scriptures, even with the prophets. But more often than not, the prophet's message is this: return to God. That's it. Return to God. Return to God. Return to your first love. God has chosen you. God has equipped you. God has blessed you so that you can be a blessing to the entire world. Oftentimes that does include predictions, because God says there are consequences. If there's faithfulness and you do return to me, I will welcome you with open arms. It doesn't matter what you've done, who you've seen, who you haven't seen, what you haven't done, what you've failed to do. I will welcome you with open arms. But the opposite's also true. See, there are consequences, and we've all experienced them in life, haven't we? There are consequences to our decisions. And the prophets often spoke very, very vividly, very passionately, very, very almost like graphically about the consequences of not following God. And this happens to be one of those passages. So again, if you want to turn with us, we're going to be looking at Isaiah chapter 9, beginning in verse 2. Isaiah 9, beginning in verse 2. And just so you know, Isaiah was reflecting on where Israel had come from, but more importantly, where they were going. So there was some really nasty stuff that was happening in the nation of Israel, but God, through the prophet Isaiah, was predicting kind of a turning point. So let's take a look at verse 2 of Isaiah chapter 9. The scriptures say, "The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of the deep, a deep darkness, a light has dawned. You have enlarged the nation, Israel, and increased their joy. They rejoice before you as people rejoice at the harvest, as warriors rejoice when dividing the plunder." And now God, or Isaiah, kind of reflects back. "For as in the day of Midian's defeat, you have shattered the yoke that burdens them, the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor. Every warrior's boot used in battle and every garment rolled in blood will be destined for burning, will be fuel for the fire." In other words, all the fighting, all the warfare, all the messiness of life, all of your enemies, the oppression that you've experienced, it's all going to burn. It's going to go away. And then in verse 6, we see this beautiful, beautiful passage and prediction. "For to us, a child is born. To us, a son is given. And the government will be on his shoulders. And he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, and Prince of Peace. Of the greatness of his government and peace, there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. The zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this." Now, again, I give you a little bit of the historical background just so we can kind of place ourselves in the context. One thing you may not know is that there were kings during this season of the nation of Israel. And those kings oftentimes were really, really good. They followed God. And of course, the prophets would come and say, keep doing what you're doing. Of course, there were kings like Ahaz during this period, time period, when he was not abiding by God's laws. He was not a faithful king. And so Isaiah's message to him was, doom is coming. But after doom, the dawn will come. It's going to be a beautiful time. Now, over the past couple of weeks, I mentioned Norton and Stephen have been diving into this passage. And we've chosen to kind of hang on that those kind of royal titles, if you will. Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, and Prince of Peace. A couple of weeks ago, Norton started by talking about that Wonderful Counselor. Now, again, you and I, whenever we read the Scriptures, we've got to ask ourselves, not just what does this mean to me, but as importantly, what did it mean for its intended audience? What did it mean for its original audience? So the question we ask is, what did the Israelites think? What did they hear? What did they believe? What were they upset about? What were they concerned about when they heard these four titles? Because again, they had this oppression that weighed heavily on their shoulders. And then in verse 6 says, but there's a new day dawning. A child is born. A son is given. He will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, and Prince of Peace. So Norton said a couple of weeks ago that that Wonderful Counselor was essentially predicting that this child wasn't just going to be a baby, a no-name baby forever, but that he was going to be a wonder worker. He was going to do extraordinary things, things that Israel maybe had never seen before. If they had, they had long forgotten them. That this baby was going to be special, that he was going to grow up and do wonders. Last week, Stephen talked about the Mighty God. And this is a really, really loaded term. If you study this term, remember Israel had oppression. They were under the thumb of country after country after country. They were split apart. They were trampled on. They were deported. Some of them had come back. It was a horrendous life for the Israelites. So imagine, when they heard Mighty God, what do you think went through their minds? Maybe like Fabio, right? Or anybody know Lou Ferrigno? That's about as good as I can. Anybody know Lou? The Incredible Hulk? You have to be like under or over 30 to know who Lou Ferrigno is. But imagine, that was the Mighty God that Israel was waiting on. And yet, as is often the case, whenever you read the Scriptures, there's paradox. Because this God, this Mighty God, came in humility. Even more, He didn't save Israel just from the oppression that was weighing heavily upon their shoulders. He saved them from a much deeper oppression, the oppression of sin. So this Mighty God came to do wonderful things. And He came in a paradoxical way as a humble baby. Today, we're going to take a look at a passage, Everlasting Father, or the title Everlasting Father. Now, just so you know, in our culture, at least in Western American culture, titles and names don't have that much meaning. There may be a couple of people in here whose parents named you very, very specifically, and your name carries meaning with it. But my parents didn't, and I would wager most of our parents kind of liked the ring of our name. But that wasn't the case in Israel. Every single name, every single title carried implicit, loaded meaning. Think about Native Americans. This is probably the best analogy I can come up with. Blackfoot or Crazy Horse, right? Even though we don't speak maybe Native American, the translation has meaning, doesn't it? If you think about Crazy Horse is probably somebody you didn't want to go to battle with, right? He was a nutcase. He was somebody you could not depend on where he was going to go. You couldn't anticipate. Well, in the same way, when the Israelites heard these titles, they carried implicit meaning. Now, here's the deal. When you and I hear the title Everlasting Father, that carries implicit meaning for every one of us here. In fact, I have asked a few of you over the past couple of weeks what fatherhood means to you. And for every single person in this room, it carries a very different meaning. For some of you, you've had a great experience with your father. For others, you may not have had a father figure who raised you, who brought you up. For others, you may have had a pretty tough experience. In fact, you may still be going through some circumstances with your earthly father. And so for us, this Everlasting Father title, much like the original hearers, this was a loaded term. This was a loaded term. So let's see if we can unpack what maybe Isaiah meant with this father. Here's two things I do know about fatherhood. No matter where you are, whether you had a great father figure, no father figure, or a terrible father figure, there are two things that are true probably for every single person in this room. One is, all of us need a father figure. Every single one of us needs a father figure. Number two, all father figures will fall short of our expectations and probably the world's expectations. Because we don't need a preacher, we don't need scriptures or the Bible or any kind of holy book to tell us what the role of fatherhood is, do we? We all know deep down. And yet all of us need it. And yet every one of our father figures will fall short. I will fall short of being an effective, perfect father figure for my kids. In fact, I did a quick Google search on some statistics on fatherhood. And again, we all know these things, but I figured I'd go ahead and put them up on the screen for you. Here's the reality of what fatherhood looks like today. Number one, one out of every three kids lives apart from their biological fathers. 24 million kids in America. This isn't worldwide. This is just here in America. One out of three, one third of kids live apart from their biological father. Check this out. In 1960, just 50 years ago, those numbers were a third what they are today. 11% of kids lived apart from their biological father. Number three, when asked kind of what's the challenge to being a good dad? This probably won't come as a surprise to most of us. Work responsibilities, right? Work responsibilities are ranked as the biggest obstacle to being a good father figure in today's culture. Number four, only slightly more than half of the fathers who were polled agreed that they feel adequately prepared for fatherhood. Now, how do you learn how to be a good father? You don't probably take a class. I don't know about too many classes out there. It's because, I mean, you've had a good father, right? We learn good fatherhood by being good fathers and having good fathers. And yet, slightly more than half said they felt adequately prepared, meaning half of them probably didn't have great examples. Number five, about 47% of fathers are divorced. 29% were never married. 18% are separated, and 5% are widowed. I don't know how all those numbers fit together, but it really paints a picture of some dire circumstances about fatherhood in America, doesn't it? Number six, 36% of children younger than six had 15 or more outings with their father in the last month. I got to admit, that looked high. I kind of look at myself and wonder, have I had 15 outings with my kids in the last month? A third of fathers have, which is pretty darn good. Number seven, 63% of teen suicides come from fatherless homes, five times the national average, whether father present homes or father absent homes, five times the national average. Check this out. Number eight, unbelievable. 90% of all runaways and homeless children are from fatherless homes, 32 times the national average. Number nine, children living in two-parent households with a poor relationship with their father are 68% more likely to smoke, drink, or use drugs compared to all teens in two-parent households. Here's a quote I found, and you may be shocked to figure out who spoke this. Don't ever doubt the impact that fathers have on their children. Children with strongly committed fathers learn about trust early on. They learn about trust with their hearts. They learn they're wanted, that they have value, that they can afford to be secure and confident and set their sights high. They get encouragement they need to keep going through the rough spots in life. Boys in particular learn from their fathers how to be fathers. I learned all those things from my own father, and I count my blessings. Now, you probably think, gosh, that probably had to come from James Dobson, right? Focus on the family. Check this out. Who said this? Former Vice President Al Gore. You knew he was a master of the internet. You didn't know that he really cared about fatherhood this way, right? I mean, that's serious business. Serious business. When the vice president says fatherhood is critical to success in our country, success in our culture, success in our nation. In our small group over the past couple of months, we've been talking about our stories, kind of sharing our stories. And these numbers that we just looked at, those are kind of numbers on a screen, and sure, they look a little kind of messy, and maybe you think, oh, that's tough. But I'll tell you what, when we go around and share stories, those numbers become real. You see, lots of folks in our small group have had great father figures in their life. But there are a lot of folks who had really, really hard experiences. And again, you don't need me to tell you, but when you don't have a good experience with the Father, what happens to self-confidence? What happens to satisfaction in life? Those things are pretty tough to come by. And the converse is also true. With great fathers, self-confidence goes up, and generally, there's a direct correlation between satisfaction in life. I say all this not to depress us, but one, to share kind of what's going on in our culture, but two, to recognize that when we hear the word ever or the phrase everlasting father, this has very, very loaded meaning for most people in this room. So let's talk a little bit about what Israel heard when they heard these words, everlasting father. Translated directly from the Hebrew, there's a couple of different ways. If you know much about how language, well, first of all, Isaiah didn't write in English. So what we're reading, almost 3,000-year-old text, or more than 3,000-year-old text, wasn't written in English. It was actually written in Hebrew. So we are translating this text. And a couple of different ways you can interpret or translate are this. The father of the future age. So everlasting father means the father of the future age or the father of the everlasting age. One who is eternally a father, or literally the father of eternity. So you have these two kind of nuances, a father and of this age yet to come or of eternity, that are loaded within that. Now, in the same way that Isaiah calls this child everlasting father, it was loaded with meaning for each of the different people that were listening. And again, they know, just like we know, that a good father figure is one who's going to provide, one who's going to protect, one who's going to care for their kids, and one who's going to love them unconditionally and timelessly, right? I tell my kids, or at least I try to tell them as often as I can, there is nothing you can do to make me love you any less. What am I saying when I communicate that to them? There is nothing you can do to make me love you any less. I'm saying that my love is unconditional. There is absolutely nothing you can do. You know that you're going to do bad things. You know that there's going to be enmity from time to time between us. But it doesn't matter how disobedient, doesn't matter how untrustworthy you are, there is absolutely nothing you can do to make me love you any less. And God, or the Israelites, heard those words when they heard everlasting father. Of course, their experience, like ours, may have been very, very different. But they heard there is absolutely nothing you can do to make me love you any less. Jews would have understood that. They would have heard everlasting father, and immediately that picture would have come to mind. In fact, Jews saw this as predicting the birth of a different son. So here we are some 3,500 roughly years later, and we read this text and you think, a son is going to be born, a child is given, and he's got all these names. What in the heck does that mean? But Israelites, when they listened, they were actually, again, under the oppression, under the leadership of this King Ahaz, who was doing a terrible job leading. And they thought, you know what? There's a new prince coming who's eventually going to be the king, and he's going to save us. In fact, Ahaz had a son named Hezekiah, and Hezekiah was a pretty good king. And yet, here's what I love about the scriptures. The scriptures did indeed mean that this son was going to be born that was going to somehow liberate or at least bring good things to the nation of Israel. But it has far deeper meaning. It has meaning for you and for me. That when this son is born, when the child is given and he has all of these names, all these titles, it's a message of hope for you and for me. In fact, when we talk about fatherhood, We know exactly what that means, don't we? I'll put a few of them up on the screen. A father is a life giver, isn't he? A father is a life giver. And I don't mean that just physically, because that's probably implicit. Not one of us could be here unless somehow our father had come together with a woman and given us life. A father is a life giver. But I don't just mean that physically. I mean spiritually as well, because all of us have been influenced by our fathers or our father's absence in terms of our spiritual life. You see, very often there's something kind of neurological that happens in our brain that draws a connection between our earthly father and our heavenly father. And so our fathers are life-giving, or the converse can also be true. Life-taking, can't they? A father should also be somebody who provides, right? And again, I don't mean this just economically or in the traditional sense, but fathers have the ability to guide, to care in ways that maybe nobody else can. Nobody else can discipline in the way that my father can. Third thing is, fathers protect. I've got two daughters, and I'd like to say that they're daddy's girls. And, you know, to say that I protect them certainly has meaning. But my 10-year-old is maybe a year or two or perhaps three, maybe 10, I hope, away from boys coming around our house. A daddy protecting takes on new meaning when that comes around. You know what I'm talking about? Dads protect. Number four, dads also care. Here's one of the ironies of parenthood. It's that whenever I'm in public and I see that parent who's kind of pretty hard on their kids, requires them to live within certain boundaries or guidelines, the thought that enters my mind, and may enter yours, is, man, they're pretty tough. And maybe the converse is also true. The parent who allows their child to kind of run free and let them be, you know, free or whatever, we think, wow, that's cool. They're kind of developing their kid. But the paradox and the irony is almost exactly the opposite, right? The parents who give clear guidelines and enforce the consequences for those guidelines are ultimately the parents who care. The fifth is this: he loves. And father's love is unconditional and it is timeless. You see, even though some of you here have probably in some ways, maybe emotionally, perhaps even physically, been estranged from your father, or maybe you have kids from whom you're estranged, I know deep down, written on the heart of every single parent, is a desire to be reunited, is a desire to be restored. It doesn't matter how much enmity is developed, every single parent will love unconditionally, without fail, without any kind of limit to time. A father's love is unconditional and timeless. That doesn't mean that a parent's always going to like everything that a child does. In fact, it's guaranteed that we won't. I caused tremendous pain to my parents, but their love for me is unconditional. Again, it doesn't take a sermon to know that, because every single one of us has that written on our hearts. In fact, I asked a few of you over the past week to tell me what words you would most hope to hear from your father, your earthly father. What words would you most want to hear from your earthly father? And here are some of the responses that you guys gave.
I love you because you... I don't know what I was going to say.
I love you and I'm proud of you.
And I love you.
I love you.
I love you.
I love you.
I'm proud of you.
I love you. I'm proud of you. You're good enough.
I love you.
I love you because you are enough, Vaz.
I'm proud of you.
Well done, son.
I'm proud of you.
I'm proud of you.
I bequeath you my father's guitar.
I'm so proud of you.
I'm proud of you.
Good job.
I'm proud of you.
I'd like to hear I love you. You're a good husband. You're a good father. No matter how much you screw up, I'm always going to love you. And for my own dad, I would have loved to hear I'm sorry for some of the mistakes.
I love you because I love you, and you are enough, and you are beautiful.
I'm coming to visit.
Hardworking, trustworthy, and faithful.
I'm proud of you, and I love you.
Sweetie, you are beautiful, and I am grateful that I was chosen to be your daddy.
See, again, we don't need a preacher. We don't need the Bible to tell us what an everlasting father is. It doesn't matter whether you're Israel hearing this 3,500 years ago or us sitting here today. Every single one of us knows what it means to have an everlasting father, right? Isn't that true? Here are some words from the scriptures about what an everlasting father is. An everlasting father gives life.
I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty, I will give water without cost from the spring of the water of life. I will be their God, and they will be my children. Revelations 21:6.
A good father provides.
Do not worry, saying, what shall we eat? or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear? Seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. Matthew 6, 31 and 33.
A father protects.
Be strong and courageous. Do not be afraid or terrified, for the Lord your God goes with you. He will never leave you nor forsake you. Deuteronomy 31, 6.
A father cares.
O Lord, you have searched me and you know me. Your right hand will hold me fast. Lead me in the way everlasting. He knows us, holds us, leads us. Psalm 139.
A father loves.
Neither death nor life, neither angels nor demons, neither the present nor the future, nor any powers, neither height nor depth, nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus our Lord. Romans 8, 38 and 39.
In other words, your everlasting Father will be everything you've ever hoped for in a father figure. This Advent season, we don't just celebrate the coming of a baby, we celebrate the coming of an everlasting Father who will fulfill every obligation, who will fulfill every dream of our fathers. This Christmas, we celebrate the everlasting Father in Jesus.